still there this morning. And we'll begin with this African-American version of Psalm 27 that you see on a little song sheet around you somewhere, I hope.
Duty. If the tape isn't already rolling, roll the tape. That's a signal to the audio technician who will record these sessions, and eventually they will be available out there on whatever is the equivalent of Holden's SoundCloud. That was our opening prayer, and we will open with such a thing each of the mornings when we do Bible study here at 9 o'clock. Another word about logistics, if you will. You heard the bell a couple minutes ago. Ordinarily, Bible study session at Holden is called to its end by the bell that signals coffee break at 10 o'clock, which I was always grateful for over the years of teaching Bible study up here, because most people who come to Bible study at Holden don't bring their backpack. And all my years of teaching at the university, I only knew when class was over when the backpacks began to zip up. And so I don't know when to stop, except whether I hear a bell or a backpack zip. But I will try really hard to stop at 10 o'clock, because coffee break will start, according to the schedule, at 10:30, which is when the staff takes its coffee break. But we will be welcome to begin our coffee break at 10 o'clock or any time that we stop here, and you can go next door to Beanie's and get coffee, or I presume up in the dining hall as well. So I think that covers the logistics. Does anybody else know a detail that ought to be mentioned about that at this point? Okay. I'm Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana, and very grateful to be here. For lots of reasons, I am grateful to be here. The last time I was up here at Holden was exactly 4 years ago this week for the autumn sojourn that we did then. Remediation was just beginning. There had been fires, but nothing like what happened last year. And so much has changed. It's the longest hiatus for me since beginning to come here in 1992, when my children were toddlers. They're adults now, and I've always been grateful, among other things, for the amount of spiritual formation that they received here in this village, which they still live by. And I'm grateful for that too. They got this while they were on vacation. They thought they were on vacation anyway. I was working, but they were on vacation, and little did they know, they were getting formed. I'm also grateful to all of you for all the years that you have put into sustaining and guiding and forming this place and this ministry. And many of you have had large parts, and all of you have had some parts. I'm also grateful to you for the kinds of communities people like you have led and formed out in other places over the years, places that have sent students to schools like Valpo so that I could get to teach them and be with them and see the benefits of your hard work probably even before you did. When they go away from home, they show who they really are. And you taught them well. So, thank you for being here, and I'm glad to be with you. Still today, you can walk up to a perfect stranger anywhere in the world, if you know his or her language, or anyone can walk up to you and ask one of two questions. What time is it? And how do I get from here to there? Once upon a time, you could ask a perfect stranger, you got a light. But that one's sort of gone off limits for a variety of reasons. But you can ask, what time is it and where am I? Because those are two signs of the most fundamental thing about us, at least from some perspectives. We are creatures of space and time. We are finite individuals who live in one space and one time, and that is so universal that you don't need an introduction to ask another person, what time is it? We get one chance to do, at least so far as we know, those of us who don't believe in reincarnation at least, you get one chance to do this human being thing on the earth. No matter what may or may not come after this, you get one chance to do this thing with fingernails and hair and the quirky irregularities in the iris of your eyeball and your particular take on colors and words. One chance to be you. And that somehow not so little secret truth is the thing we're going to talk about in one way or another all week with our theme, Time's Ever Rolling Stream, which, as we learned yesterday and we recited by heart, part of the hymn that this comes from, Our God, Our Help in Ages Past, which contains those lines that we recited together about how time, like an ever-rolling stream, soon. And now the rest, the translation keeps differing. I didn't realize that once upon a time it had said, bears all our sons away. By the time I learned it, it was soon bears us all away. Now, in the ELW, we try to soften that a little bit, and it says, bears all our years away. As if it could bear away our years without bearing us downstream as well somehow. We fly forgotten as a dream dies at opening day. You know that reality, don't you? You wake up and you, I had a dream, but I can't completely remember what it was. And we become like a dream that the world later on will think, oh yeah, well, there was somebody like that. There's a gravestone somewhere with that name on it that I don't know anymore just who that was. We say to each other, we'll never forget you. We say that at funerals after tragedies. We'll never forget. But we do. And the rest of the world does too. And all of those images, of course, come from Psalm 90, which we will return to eventually in a little bit. The point is that our time is limited. Although another truth is that we don't really know what time is. If you ask philosophers and physicists, time is a real mystery. But if you listen to us, you might really think that we can buy time or save time as though it's some kind of commodity or waste time. Or we can kill the clock that measures time. We have wrinkles in time, or at least we've heard tell of them. We have time travel, we have high time, and sacred time, and downtime, and all sorts of other time. But showtime, there's another one. Some of us believe in things beyond space and time, although the language that we have to talk about that is like all other language of theology. It's metaphorical, and therefore it's partly true and partly not, but it's all we've got. And so theology is the work of tending metaphors and doing the best you can with limited tools. But just think about the very phrase beyond time or beyond space. Beyond is, it's a metaphor, it's a preposition, it's a picture, it's a piece of spatial and perhaps temporal language. We only have finite space-time-bound minds for trying to understand all these things. You know, we ran up against this last night in that movie, and Dan Spencer and I were talking about this at breakfast. We saw that glowing dot in the middle of the screen expand out, but if you really understand what it was trying to depict, there was nothing for it to expand into. There's nothing, and then there's something. There's nothing, you know, the category of beyond time or beyond space is really nonsense. There's nothing out there. All there is what is, and we don't even understand that very well. In any case, this finitude, I will submit to you, eventually drives us crazy, at least to some extent or another. Although at times it can be a comfort. You could ask Job, who finally at the end of his story comforted himself that he was but dust and ashes. And that's what that last line of his really means. It doesn't, I mean, I would have to give you a long Hebrew lesson before you could figure out why I'm claiming this, but he doesn't really say, you know, I guess I'll go eat worms. He's comforting himself that he doesn't have to take on this massive job description that God just cited. That's not my job. I am mortal. I don't need to worry about that. So there are moments when we're grateful, but mostly we're not grateful. And as I quoted that one, my favorite line yesterday, we long for immortality even though plenty of us don't know what to do with ourselves on a rainy Sunday afternoon. That's people who can't read books, I guess. Many have written and taught and thought provocatively about the way that our finitude shapes our lives but to my mind, none more fully or wisely than Ernest Becker, someone who taught at least my generation, or helped us anyway, to see how it is that going the way of sparrows and grasshoppers and becoming food for worms, despite the intricacies of our minds and our ability to craft poetry and to fall in love and to appreciate beauty and to write songs and to invent technology. All of that we can do, and yet we still end up like the grasshoppers and disappear. And it's simply too much for us. We cannot bear that truth. And so Becker teaches us our fear of utter extinction, coupled with our fundamental expendability and the knowledge that the world will go on without us as though we never existed, as though we've never lived, becomes the mainspring of all that we do in life, whether as individuals or as communities, even societies and cultures. It's the genesis of all of our self-creating, self-sustaining, self-justifying, self-memorializing work, not to mention the genesis of culture and religion and ceaseless war. We spend all that we have, all the time, every day, striving not to die, either literally or symbolically. That's what runs our life, says Ernest Becker. And if you just get down below the surface of what we do, that's what's underneath there. And yet, we are people who gather as a community that has learned to call our fundamental expendability grace. And by the way, I presume you may have noticed in that film last night as well, I never thought about this before either. It's not just each one of us that is fundamentally expendable. The entire universe didn't have to be and almost wasn't. I'd never thought about that if the explosion had been at just a little higher or lower velocity, we wouldn't be here talking about this. An amazing thought. It didn't have to be, but it is. And none of us had to be, but we are. And we call that grace, because it means it's all a gift. There's no way you could have earned your chance to be here. Moreover, together we follow someone who says, "Come die with me. You will find your life by losing it. And the quickest way to waste it all together is to try your hardest not to lose it." Where is the wisdom in that one's teaching? That's what we're about this week. And brace yourself. We're going to start in Genesis and go all the way to Revelation. But I promise that I will skip Leviticus. There's an interesting time problem at the very beginning of the book of Genesis that I'm sure at least some of you have thought about. In chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, God creates light and separates it from the darkness. And then in chapter 1, verse 5, we hear that we have evening and morning, which God dubs night and day, which are our units of timekeeping, derived from the spinning of Earth as it orbits around the sun. That's the only way we've ever kept time. That's what time is to us. An accounting of the times that this planet has spun around in its own orbiting around the sun. And then we calculate the larger frame by the orbit that we make as we spin around that sun. And yet, Genesis says we were counting that way, or somebody was counting that way, before there was ever a sun, or a moon, or stars, or any of that. There's a nice mystery for you. (Clears throat) I kept thinking last night when that film was telling us about billions of years and tens of billions of years and all the light years, the millions and billions of light years that the pieces of the cosmos are apart from each other. And I kept thinking, and every one of those things is measured by one spin of the planet, one circuit of light and dark on this little speck. But that's the only way we've got to measure it. And what sense does it really make to think of measuring things of that magnitude with our little clock, which is our tiny little universe, which is nothing more than a molecule of some kind that's floating around? Indeed, it's a mystery. More importantly, for our conversation, here's another mystery of sorts about our finitude. We don't get as clear a picture as you might think, at least not when you're a kid or in catechism class, about the precise meaning and role of death, the thing that ends our days as individuals and makes us go the way of the sparrows and the grasshoppers. The Creator, Yahweh, as some people say it in Hebrew, tells the Adam creature, the mud creature, in chapter 2, verse 15, that if you eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, on the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. And the tradition that we've taken from that is that human beings were created immortal, but only die because they stole the vegetables from the forbidden source. Or fruit, excuse me. But the text doesn't really support that. And it could only mean that the eater of that forbidden fruit would only die sooner rather than later. And as it turns out, of course, the serpent in the story is at least partly right. He said, oh, you won't die. And sure enough, they ate it and they didn't die. In the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. Well, no, didn't happen. So what else is not true of all the stuff that we've heard? On the other hand, mortality did begin that very day, because at the end of the chapter, God sewed garments of skin for those now ashamed to be naked people. So somebody had to die and forfeit their skin so that we could now be clothed. So death does begin that day, a kind of death for others. If mortality was not a part of the original scheme, think about this. What kind of world would this be? Especially if it did include reproduction, procreation. Assuming that procreation was part of the original plan, we'd have long, long, long ago needed new planets to populate, and would have needed to find our way to get there, else we would have had a nightmarish experience bursting out from the Garden of Delight, the Garden of Eden. So maybe there's another reason to join the ancient and medieval Christians who said, O felix culpa, thank God for sin, else we would have really had a mess. Well, then there's the time mystery in Genesis 5, the pre-flood genealogy of those generations that lived anywhere from 365 to 969 years. And I don't intend to talk about that. All I'll tell you is that if you really want to have your mind boggled, you should read the Babylonian equivalent of that part of the story. And the people in those generations in the Babylonian story lived for as long as 75,000 years. So Methuselah had nothing on the Babylonians. In any case, as the Bible puts it, and so we sleep with our ancestors. That's what finally becomes of us, according to the Hebrew Bible. Or at least we're told the kings sleep with their ancestors. That phrase happens to be used only for kings, beginning with David in 1 Kings 2 and then Solomon in 1 Kings 11, and for every king thereafter, and so-and-so slept with his ancestors, and his son so-and-so took over the throne. We hear nothing about the lives of those kings like you hear about the Egyptian kings who are prepared for life in the next world. In the Hebrew Bible, when you die, you are dead, and you sleep with your ancestors. Some of the most famous of our forebears in the biblical story slept with their ancestors in burial sites whose purchase agreements have been kept until today, kept for millennia. And that was frightfully important for the people. The stories like Genesis 23, which tells the whole long story of the negotiations that Abram had with the Hittites for the purchase of the cave of Machpelah because he needed to bury Sarah. Why would you keep that entire document? It bears the marks of the literature of the priestly writing of the 6th century BC when the people had lost the land and the city of Jerusalem had been razed and they had nothing. And they pined away in Babylon, but they knew one thing, the priestly writer wrote, we still own the graves. That much of the sacred land still belongs to us because our ancestors dwell there. They're sleeping, but they're there, and we're not. The other way that the Bible describes what becomes of us in the pre-Christian portions of it anyway, is that we all go down to Sheol. S-H-E-O-L, I would write on the black on the whiteboard if it were close by. We all go down to Sheol, which literally swallows up all the critics of Moses in Numbers chapter 16. You remember that story? 250 of the leaders went to Moses and said, you know, this whole people is chosen. What's with you and Aaron acting so high and mighty? And Moses said, ooh, I'm really sorry you asked that. And he and Aaron step back at God's direction and the earth swallows up and the whole 250 went down into Sheol in an instant. So it can happen literally. It happens figuratively all the time as Jonah sings in the belly of the whale or as David saying in 2 Samuel 22 when he was fleeing from Saul and felt that Sheol was about to swallow him up. When you do go down to Sheol, you want to go peaceably, and Jacob fears he won't be able to go down to Sheol in peace when two of his sons end up lost to him thanks to the chicanery of the older brothers, and now Joseph is long gone, dead, he presumes, and Benjamin is carted off as a hostage. And now poor Jacob, with his old gray hair, must go down to Sheol without peace. David, much later, wants to get rid of his hitman, Joab, to cover up the tracks of all the nasty things that have happened over the years in his kingdom. And so he makes sure to have Joab murdered. But somebody else will do it, which always is the way David had his dirty work done. David killed countless people, but somebody else always did it. Remember Uriah? But now he makes sure that Joab, with his old gray hair, will not go down to Sheol in peace. Poor old Job believes that the only peace he'll ever get is in Sheol. In Job chapter 17. So Job had a different relationship to death than most of us for understandable reasons. There's a bit of a joke, I think, in Psalm 6 about Sheol. The psalmist writes that the people in Sheol, the dead, are beyond giving praise to God. So the psalmist asks, why does God ever send anybody there? So God, what are you thinking? The people that die can't praise you anymore. So why send them there? You like it when people praise you, right? So don't do that. I like that logic. And yet, as we learn in Psalm 139, we'll come back to this at least once or twice. Even should you make your bed in Sheol, you can't get away from God. There's no place that God won't be there or find you, and we'll make much of that later. Psalm 49 says quite a lot about Sheol. It's the great leveler, and Sheol is kind of a joke on the wealthy and the powerful, and even on the wise. When we look at the wise, they die. The fool and the dolt perish together, and they leave their wealth to others. Their graves are their home forever, their dwelling place to all generations. That's a phrase we'll hear in another way. A dwelling place to all generations. Mortals cannot abide in their pomp. They are like the animals that perish. Such is the fate of the foolhardy, the end of those who are pleased with their lot. Like sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd. Straight to the grave they descend, and their form shall waste away. But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. And exactly how does that work? Do not be afraid when some become rich, when the wealth of their houses increases, for when they die, they'll carry nothing away. Their wealth will not go down after them. Though in their lifetime they count themselves happy, for you are praised when you do well for yourself, they will go to the company of their ancestors who will never again see the light. Mortals cannot abide in their pomp. They are like the animals that perish. So we get to laugh at those who are more powerful than us, whether they have oppressed us or not, because we're all ending up in Sheol together. And if you think you're somebody in Sheol, we're all alike. A slightly different idea about Sheol in Psalm 9, verses 17 to 20, a different idea of justice. I'm going to quickly find that and read that. The wicked shall depart to Sheol, all the nations that forget God. For the needy shall not always be forgotten, nor the hope of the poor perish forever. Rise up, O Lord, do not let mortals prevail, let the nations be judged before you. Put them in fear, O Lord, let the nations know that they are only human. This is something else that we're going to have to talk about. If everybody dies and goes down to Sheol, and everybody ends up down there together, and it's the great leveler, where's the justice in that? Because even though we all get forgotten, there was in time, which we find so precious, great injustice. And who's going to ever do an accounting of that? Well, at the very least, Psalm 9 begs God not to forget. We're all going to Sheol, but God, don't forget us poor ones, us needy ones, us little people. And there are promises in other psalms and in other places that God does not forget. Now, this, of course, is a metaphor. as though God has a psychology that the rest of us can understand, or that by our psychological understandings we can fathom the mind and the workings of God. But just to accept our metaphor, if God remembers us, that's really something, right? To not be forgotten by God, who is not bound as we are in space and time, means there's something about us that endures forever. In the memory of God, we live. There's an interesting metaphor. But texts like this speak about being ransomed from Sheol. But we can't look at everything in the Hebrew Bible that offers hope in the face of the grave and Sheol, but maybe a couple more psalms will help. Psalm 27, the psalm that we sang from this morning as we began, we're going to look at that for just a moment, and if you have a Bible with you, you might want to turn to Psalm 27 for a few moments. I'll just tell you, I don't know that any of you would have reason to know this, but Jews throughout the world are in the season of preparing for the High Holy Days that extend from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, ending on October 12th. But beginning on the Sabbath, which is known in the tradition as Rosh Chodesh Elul, the Sabbath that happened back by our calendar on September 2nd into the 3rd, so about 3 weeks ago now. From that Sabbath until Yom Kippur on October 12th, morning and evening, in their prayers, the Jewish community prays Psalm 27. Twice a day, they will be praying this psalm, and we're going to open our day with it each day as well. All the songs with which we'll open our sessions, Mary and Tom will lead us in another way to sing Psalm 27. And I want to look particularly at verses 4 to 6 for a moment. One thing I asked of the Lord, that will I seek after, to live in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. For he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will set me high on a rock. Now my head is lifted up above my enemies all around me, and I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody to the Lord. So do you suppose that means that the only way to be safe is to find a way to live in the temple? Or as the ancients might have thought of it, the tabernacle? Or as we might think about it, you get in trouble, you go hide in church. I don't think so. Because if you know the history of the idea of Yahweh's tent, the exilic portions of Isaiah make a great thing about how the Lord, who we once thought dwelled in the temple in Jerusalem and only there, is really the Lord who stretches the heavens out like a tent, so that the entire world, the whole cosmos, is Yahweh's tent, Yahweh's tabernacle, Yahweh's dwelling, and there's no place we can go except that we are still in Yahweh's tent, and Yahweh will never lose track of us. Dead or alive, you're still in the tent so long as you are on the earth. Verses 7 and following raise an issue that we're very familiar with. Hear, O Lord, when I cry aloud, be gracious to me and answer me. Come, my heart says, seek his face. Your face, O Lord, do I seek. Do not hide your face from me. That happens a lot, that even in Yahweh's tent, we experience God forsakenness. Yahweh's face is hidden from us, and we cannot understand or see ourselves as being in the presence of God. And so we sometimes pray other songs like, my God, why have you abandoned me, forsaken me? And then a word of hope that we don't know exactly what the thinking might have been for people of the era of the Hebrew Bible, but I believe that I shall see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord, be strong, and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord. Christians have taken that and made hymns about heaven, being taken someday into the land of the living. I think this psalm asks that in the here and now, Lord, in the land of the living, not in the land of Sheol, let us see your salvation. I've already noted, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, Psalm 139, which talks about the presence of God everywhere, even in what appears to be God-forsakenness. Where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and settle at the farthest limits of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will cover me, and the light around me become night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day, for darkness is as light to you. So even death cannot separate us from God by the thinking of that psalm. And we'll see how the tradition uses that kind of thinking as we go along. Psalm 90, the psalm that sets the theme for our time together by way of that hymn. Let's look at that a little bit more in detail. We've still got about 17 minutes here. I think we can do this. By the way, I should have said, if you want to stop me to ask questions, you can do it now. I realize that I start talking and I kind of march fast and take no prisoners. But if you want to stop me, please wave boldly.
Could you just give me your elevator definition of Sheol?
It's a metaphor. It's the land of the shades. It's not a place where anybody has experiences. It's just where the dead go. And it's talked about as a place as we've heard, I mean, it's the place that everybody ends up. So don't ever think that you're really something because you're ending up in Sheol just like everybody else.
I think some lay people just equate it with hell, which it's not.
Well, eventually, the whole talk about hell, we'll get to that tomorrow when we get to the fork in time. What we call hell, and this is just the elevator preview of that, we borrow metaphors from all over the place to talk about the place you don't want to end up, as opposed to the place you do. And one of the images that some eventually use was Sheol. Another one is Gehenna, which is a infamous valley near Jerusalem, where kings that involved themselves in such things sacrificed their children in order to preserve their sovereignty. And so it was known as the place of wasted lives and burnt up youth. Some people think it was also the landfill outside Jerusalem, which meant it was the place of wasted everything, wasted lives. But the New Testament borrows the Greek underworld name, Hades. Hades is the Greek underworld where you have all kinds of experiences, and sort of like the ancient Babylonians visioned it. You cross rivers and have adventures, and you try to prove yourself and maybe try to work your way back, but it never quite works. And on and on. So there's all these visions that are borrowed as ways to talk about things that we have no experience of and cannot understand, and so we borrow images and metaphors to say, you don't want to be there.
Fred, you said something about 250 people, I don't know which part of we're talking about, just disappeared. 250,000, wasn't it?
Well, first 250 disappeared. What's your question?
Well, did they just die? Is that what they're saying? Or you made it sound like it was an actual thing that happened.
Numbers, I'm just telling you what the story says. There's a story in Numbers 16 that says that people went to Moses and accused him of being high and mighty, and he says, oh no, that's really too bad you asked that. And then God orders him and Aaron to step aside, and the earth opens up and swallows the 250. And then 10,000 more get angry about this, and they go to Moses and say, look what you did now! You killed the best people we got! And the 10,000 of them are slain instantly. The moral of the story, number 16 is part of the priestly tradition, which means to say, don't question the priests. And guess who put that in there? Every story has a context, including the context for why it was put where it is. And this story is meant to say, don't question the priests, because God would just soon kill you as look at you if you question the priests. The Bible's full of rough stuff.
What? No more questions.
I'm retired.
Mary, we're in trouble.
So Psalm 90. Well, now we don't have quite so much time. Maybe I'll just hit some highlights of this. There's a particular point I want to make about this psalm, although there's many, many great points. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. That word dwelling place, this is a sort of a biblical theologian's dream life. I wish the Septuagint would have translated that phrase with the word that's used in John's gospel for the abiding places that are all over, but that's not what it is. It's a word translated even in the Greek as a place for fugitives to hide. It's a hiding place for people in trouble. You have been our refuge, say some translations, in all generations. But it's a place. It's very definitely a place. And God is called a place where we can hide. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world from everlasting to everlasting, you turn us back to dust and say, turn back, you mortals. For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it's passed, like a watch in the night. So clearly this psalm assumes, as does, for example, Psalm 104, that it's God who ends our life. Psalm 104 says God does it by taking our breath away, because God's the one who gave us breath in the first place. You could read it in Genesis 3. When human beings kill each other, they spill blood. And when your blood runs out and goes in the ground, you're also dead. That's how human beings do it. God does it by taking our breath away. You sweep them away, they're like a dream, like grass that's renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed, in the evening it fades and withers. We're consumed by your anger, by your wrath we are overwhelmed. You've set our iniquities before us, our secret sins in the light of your countenance, so don't ever think you can get away with claiming you didn't deserve what happened to you. God also knows all of our shameful secrets, and they can be held up in the light. For all our days pass away under your wrath, our years come unto an end like a sigh. The days of our life are like 70 years, or maybe 80 if we're strong. That's where we get that phrase that's used as a cliche, even in people who've never heard of the Bible. 70 years is how the King James put it. Even then, their span is only toil and trouble, and soon they're gone and we fly away. Who considers the power of your anger? Your wrath is great as the fear that's due you. And then, in a way, here's the punchline of the whole psalm. So, God, teach us to count our days, or in the King James, to number our days, so that we may, and I still like it best the old way, apply our hearts unto wisdom. So, this is our life, God. Tell us how to use our days so that, to do an accounting of our days so that we can live wisely and not just as fools and sinners, though we are fools and sinners. Then a plea that God would have compassion on us. And finally, I'm going to skip to the end for the sake of time. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and prosper for us the work of our hands. Oh, prosper the work of our hands. So here are we mortals asking God to make our deeds in this world like God's deeds, because this verb for what this last verse prays God to do is the verb for what God does with God's own deeds. God establishes God's own deeds. God, this is poetry elsewhere for God establishing the earth and establishing the foundations of the earth, and establishing the mountains, and establishing the heavens. God, please make the work of our hands as established as your own. Give some life to our creations like you do for your creations. But the thing I really want to ponder here with you for a moment is to think of God as our place of refuge, God as our eternal dwelling place, and to just give you a vision, I'm going to read something for you that a friend of mine, a dear friend of mine, wrote. Actually, he said it, and I wrote it down so that somebody else could read it the next day, the day after he died, at a Reformation festival. A friend of mine died after a long battle with metastasized malignancies, and I spent much of his last days with him. And he knew he had this writing assignment that he wasn't going to get to finish by delivering himself. So as he lay on his deathbed, this is what I wrote down of his thoughts. And this captures Psalm 90 for me. The man's name is David Tremper. He was my colleague at Valparaiso for 30 years in the theology department. He wasn't ever up here. And I'm just realizing as I'm starting to do this, you're going to have to forgive me for my voice cracking. It's okay. From the perspective of my deathbed, the promise of life everlasting that I have named in the credo and trusted since childhood has become more precious than ever. Yet it cannot be what we so commonly and easily assume, a mere extension, even an endless prolonging of our days. The prospect of more and more days, even on the other side of some boundary, now seems more burden than hope. The ancient Psalms help us to understand the promise more truly. The one we call Psalm 90 prays that God would teach us to number our days so our hearts might learn wisdom. Beginning with the truth that our days are full of iniquity, fly like a dream and come to an end with a sigh. But that same song begins with a promise, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. There is the promise of life everlasting. Not time of any sort, however new or long, but a place. We dwell in the Lord. That is enough. Or as the apostle put it, our lives are hid with Christ in God. Here, in the communion of those who have died with Christ in baptism, we find our resting place. There we abide, for now and for eternity. I believe in the life everlasting. Amen. That's, I think, what Psalm 90, verse 1 gives us. And I will simply remind you, if you've never heard this, the Hebrew verb for saving, the verb from which we get Jesus' name, Yeshua, is the verb Yasha, with the apocrypated version of Yahweh's name attached to it, so that it means Yahweh saves. But what the verb Yasha really means is to make a place, to give room, to give space. Which is what an ancient nomadic people always needs, is a place. Give us a place, God. But it also is to give us a place in eternity when we have no place. And so, to me, this poem of Psalm 90 prays for the life everlasting in God, wherever that is. You gather, obviously, that I'm using space-time language to talk about things that are beyond space and time and which are impossible. I've got only a minute or two left, and I just want to remind you of a couple of visions that also appear in the Hebrew Bible that we call eschatological visions or even apocalyptic visions of something beyond time that the ancient Israelites believed in and hoped for in the latter stages of the era of the Hebrew Bible. And I'm just going to refer you to them, and we'll come back to these for other reasons later. Isaiah 25, verses 6 to 9, is the vision on the holy mountain of the great feast that God will set for all peoples, at which he will wipe away every tear, and death will be no more, and we will feast on wine and fat things. We read this every third year on Easter Sunday as a vision of the new reality that we hope for. Isaiah 65, verses 17 to 25 is a long vision that we don't have time to rehearse today, but it rehearses a new heaven and a new earth, a new creation, in which there won't any longer be the problem of burying babies who live only for a few days. Nobody's going to have to bury their babies. Nobody's going to plant a field and somebody else end up having to harvest it because you didn't live long enough to reap your crops. Everyone will get a full, long life. It's the vision that ends with the peaceable kingdom picture of the lion laying down next to the lamb, although I never have figured out what the lion's supposed to do with those big old choppers. Eat grass? But in any case, what we want out of this is no more tragic early death. And it's a promise of Isaiah 65 that we will have that. Zechariah 14 promises a day when God will knock over the Mount of Olives, which was the cemetery of Jerusalem. And the holy ones, it's a miracle. And the holy ones will come out of the graves that get opened when God kicks over the Mount of Olives and come marching in to the city. And so forever after we've been singing, oh, when the saints go marching in, oh, when the saints go marching in. And boy, do we want to be in that number. That's one of our visions of hope. So those visions also appear in the Hebrew Bible, and we'll return to them because each of them has issues that we have to find some other way to deal with. But we're going to find a way that we can live in those visions even now. So thank you. People are free to go for coffee, but I'll stick around for some questions if people want to ask or talk.